had seen hard wear. Salt stains patterned his boots. The enamel of his nails was chipped. His lace was soiled by sweat, and she could see where the end of his cloak was fraying.
And the Salon picked his nose as if his snout was gold.
He stood with his hands crossed at the wrists, his palms resting on the pommels of his blades, a curving Dothraki arrack on his left hip, a Moorish stiletto on his right. Their hilts were a matched pair of golden women, naked and wanton. "Are you skilled in the use of those handsome blades?" Danny asked him.
"Prendel and Salah would tell you so, if dead men could talk. I can't know they as lived, unless I have loved a woman, slain a foreman, and eaten a fine meal. And the days that I have lived are as numberless as the stars in the sky. I make of slaughter a thing of beauty, and many a tumbler and fire dancer has wept to the gods that they might be half so quick, a quarter so graceful. I would tell you the names of all the men I have slain, but before I could finish, your dragons would grow large as castles. The walls of Yankai would crumble into yellow dust, and winter would come and go and come again."
Danny laughed. She liked the swagger she saw in this Dario Naharis. "Draw your sword, and swear it to my service." In a blink, Dario's arrack was free of its sheath. His submission was as outrageous as the rest of him, a great swoop that brought his face down to her toes.
"My sword is yours. My life is yours. My love is yours. My blood, my body, my songs, you own them all. I live and die at your command, fair queen."
"Then live," Danny said, "and fight for me tonight."
"That would not be wise, my queen."
Ser Jorah gave Dario a cold, hard stare.
"Keep this one here, under guard, until the battle's fought and won."
She considered for a moment, then shook her head. "If he can give us the Stormcrows, surprise is certain."
"And if he betrays you, surprise is lost."
Danny looked down at the sellsword again. He gave her such a smile that she flushed and turned away. "He won't."
"How can you know that?"
She pointed to the lumps of blackened flesh the dragons were consuming bite by bloody bite. "I would call that proof of his sincerity. Dario Naharis, have your Stormcrows ready to strike the Yunkish rear when my attack begins. Can you get back safely?"
"If they stop me, I will say I have been scouting and saw nothing."
The Tyrushi rose to his feet, bowed, and swept out. Ser Jorah Mormont lingered.
"Your Grace," he said too bluntly, "that was a mistake. We know nothing of this man."
"We know he's a great fighter."
"A great talker, you mean?"
"He brings us the Stormcrows. And he has blue eyes."
500 sellswords of uncertain loyalty?"
"All loyalties are uncertain in such times as these," Danny reminded him. "And I shall be betrayed twice more, once for gold and once for love."
"Daenerys, I'm thrice your age," Ser Jorah said. "I have seen how false men are. Very few are worthy of trust, and Dario Naharis is not one of them. Even his beard wears false colors."
That angered her. "Whilst you have an honest beard, is that what you're telling me? You are the only man I should ever trust?" He stiffened.
I do not say that."
"You say it every day. Piat Pris a liar, Zaros a schemer, Belwas a braggart, Arston an assassin. Do you think I'm still some virgin girl, that I cannot hear the words behind the words?"
"Your Grace," she bulled over him,
"you have been a better friend to me than any I have known, a better brother than Viserys ever was. You are the first of my Queen's Guard, the commander of my army, my most valued counsellor, my good right hand. I honour and respect and cherish you, but I do not desire you
Jorah Mormont, and I weary of your trying to push every other man in the world away from me. So I must needs rely on you, and you alone. It will not serve, and it will not make me love you any better." Mormont had flushed red when she first began, but by the time Danny was done, his face was pale again. He stood still as stone.
"If my queen commands," he said, curt and cold.
Danny was warm enough for both of them. "She does," she said. "She commands. Now, go see to your unsullied, sir. You have a battle to fight and win." When he was gone, Danny threw herself down on her pillows beside her dragons. She had not meant to be so sharp as Sir Jorah, but his endless suspicion had finally woken her dragon. "He will forgive me," she told herself. "I am his liege." Danny found herself wondering whether he was right about Dario. She felt very lonely all of a sudden. Mira Mazdur had promised that she would never bear a living child. "House Targaryen will end with me." That made her sad. "You must be my children," she told the dragons, "my three fierce children. Arston says dragons live longer than men, so you will go on after I am dead." Drogon looped his neck around to nip at her hand. His teeth were very sharp, but he never broke her skin when they played like this. Danny laughed and rolled him back and forth until he roared, his tail lashing like a whip. "It is longer than it was," she saw, "and tomorrow it will be longer still. They grow quickly now, and when they are grown, I shall have my wings." Mounted on a dragon, she could lead her own men into battle, as she had in Astapor, but as yet they were still too small to bear her weight. A stillness settled over her camp when midnight came and went. Danny remained in her pavilion with her maids, while Arsten Whitebeard and Strong Belwas kept the guard. The waiting is the hardest part. To sit in her tent with idle hands while her battle was being fought without her made Danny feel half a child again. The hours crept by on turtle feet. Even after Jiqui robbed the nuts from her shoulders, Danny was too restless for sleep. Miss Andy offered to sing her a lullaby of the peaceful people, but Danny shook her head. "Bring me Arsten," she said. When the old man came, she was curled up inside her hakar pelt, whose musty smell still reminded her of Drogo. "I cannot sleep when men are dying for me, Whitebeard," she said. "Tell me more of my brother, Rhaegar, if you would. I'd like the tale you told me on the ship of how he decided that he must be a warrior."
"Your grace is kind to say so."
"Viserys said that our brother won many tourneys." Arston bowed his white head respectfully.
"It is not meet for me to deny his grace's words."
"But," Danny said sharply, "tell me. I command it."
"Prince Rhaegar's prowess was unquestioned, but he seldom entered the lists. He never loved the Song of Swords the way that Robert did, or Jaime Lannister. It was something he had to do, a task the world had set him. He did it well, for he did everything well. That was his nature. But he took no joy in it. Men said that he loved his harp much better than his lance."
"He won some tourney, surely," said Danny, disappointed.
"When he was young, his grace rode brilliantly in a tourney at Storm's End, defeating Lord Stefan Baratheon, Lord Jason Malister, the Red Viper of Dawn, and a mystery knight who proved to be the infamous Simon Toyne, chief of the Kingswood Outlaws. He broke 12 lances against Sir Arthur Dane that day."
"Was he the champion then?"
No, Your Grace. That honour went to another knight of the King's Guard who unhorsed Prince Rhaegar in the final tilt."
Danny did not want to hear about Rhaegar being unhorsed.
But what tourneys did my brother win?
Your Grace,
the old man hesitated,
he won the greatest tourney of them all.
Which was that? Danny demanded.
The tourney Lord Wint staged at Harrenhal beside the God's Eye, in the year of the false spring. A notable event. Besides the jousting, there was a melee in the old-style fort between 7 teams of knights, as well as archery and axe-throwing, a horse race, a tournament of singers, a mummer show, and many feasts and frolics. Lord Wint was as open-handed as he was rich. The lavish purses he proclaimed drew hundreds of challengers. Even your royal father came to Harrenhal when he had not left the Red Keep for long years. The greatest lords and mightiest champions of the 7 kingdoms rode in that tourney, and the Prince of Dragonstone bested them all.
But that was the tourney when he crowned Lyanna Stark as Queen of Love and Beauty, said Danny. Princess Elia was there, his wife. And yet my brother gave the crown to the Stark girl, and later stole her away from her betrothed. How could he do that? Did the Dornish woman treat him so ill?
It is not for such as me to say what might have been in your brother's heart, Your Grace. The Princess Elia was a good and gracious lady, though her health was ever delicate.
Danny pulled the lion pelt tighter about her shoulders. Viserys said once that it was my fault for being born too late. She had denied it hotly, she remembered, going so far as to tell Viserys that it was his fault for not being born a girl. He beat her cruelly for that insolence. If I had been born more timely, he said, Rhaegar would have married me instead of Elia, and it would all have come out different. If Rhaegar had been happy in his wife, he would not have needed the Stark girl.
Perhaps so, Your Grace.
Whitebeard paused a moment.
But I am not certain it was in Rhaegar to be happy.
You make him sound so sour, Danny protested.
Not sour, no, but there was a melancholy to Prince Rhaegar, a sense...
The old man hesitated again. Say it, she urged. A sense
of doom. He was born in grief, my queen, and that shadow hung over him all his days.
Viserys had spoken of Rhaegar's birth only once. Perhaps the tale saddened him too much. It was the shadow of Summerhall that haunted him, was it not?
Yes, and yet Summerhall was the place the prince loved best. He would go there from time to time, with only his harp for company. Even the knights of the King's Guard did not attend him there. He liked to sleep in the ruined hall, beneath the moon and stars, and whenever he came back, he would bring a song. When you heard him play his high harp with the silver strings and sing of twilights and tears and the death of kings, you could not but feel that he was singing of himself and those he loved.
What of the usurper? Did he play sad songs as well? Arston chuckled.
Robert liked songs that made him laugh. The bawdier the better. He only sang when he was drunk, and then it was like to be a cask of ale. Oh, 54 tons. Oh, the bear and the maiden fair. Robert was much...
As one, her dragons lifted their heads and roared. Horses! Danny leapt to her feet, clutching the lion pelt. Outside, she heard Strong Belwas bellow something, and then other voices, and the sounds of many horses. Irri, go see who... The tent flap pushed open, and Sir Jorah Mormont entered. He was dusty and spattered with blood, but otherwise none the worse for battle. The exile knight went to one knee before Danny and said, "Your Grace, I bring you victory. The storm crows turned their cloaks, the slaves broke, and the second sons were too drunk to fight, just as you said. 200 dead, young Kai for the most part. Their slaves threw down their spears and ran, and their sellswords yielded. We have several thousand captives." "Our own losses?" "A dozen, if that many." Only then did she allow herself a smile. "Rise, my good brave bear. Was Grasden taken, or the Titan's bastard?" "Grasden went to Yunkai to deliver your terms." Sir Jorah got to his feet. "Mira fled once he realized the storm crows had turned. I have men hunting him. He shouldn't escape us long." "Very well," Danny said. "Sellsword or slave, spare all those who will pledge me their faith. If enough of the second sons will join us, keep the company intact." The next day, they marched the last 3 leagues to Yunkai. The city was built of yellow bricks instead of red. Elsewise, it was Astapor all over again, with the same crumbling walls and high stepped pyramids and a great harpy mounted above its gates. The wall and towers swarmed with crossbowmen and slingers. Sir Jorah and Grey Worm deployed her men. Iri and Jiqui raised her pavilion, and Danny sat down to wait. On the morning of the third day, the city gates swung open and a line of slaves began to emerge. Danny mounted her silver to greet them. As they passed, little Missandei told them that they owed their freedom to Daenerys Stormborn, the Unburnt, Queen of the Seven Kingdoms of Westeros and Mother of Dragons.
"Mysa!"
a brown-skinned man shouted out at her. He had a child on his shoulder, a little girl, and she screamed the same word in her thin voice.
"Mysa! Mysa!"
Danny looked at Missandei. "What are they shouting?"
"It is Giscari, the old pure tongue. It means mother."
Danny felt a lightness in her chest. "I will never bear a living child," she remembered. Her hand trembled as she raised it. Perhaps she smiled. She must have, because the man grinned and shouted again, and others took up the cry.
"Maeser," they called. "Maeser! Maeser!"
They were all smiling at her, reaching for her, kneeling before her. "Myla," some called her, while others called "Alala," or "Kathi," or "Tato." But whatever the tongue, it all meant the same thing. Mother. "They are calling me Mother." The chant grew, spread, swelled. It swelled so loud that it frightened her horse, and the mare backed and shook her head and lashed her silver-grey tail. It swelled until it seemed to shake the yellow walls of Yunkai. More slaves were streaming from the gates every moment, and as they came, they took up the call. They were running toward her now, pushing, stumbling, wanting to touch her hand, to stroke her horse's mane, to kiss her feet. Her poor blood riders could not keep them all away, and even strong Belwas grunted and growled in dismay. Sir Jorah urged her to go, but Danny remembered a dream she had dreamed in the House of the Undying. "They will not hurt me," she told him. "They are my children, Jorah." She laughed, put her heels into a horse, and rode to them, the bells in her hair ringing sweet victory. She trotted, then cantered, then broke into a gallop, her braids streaming behind. The freed slaves parted before her. "Mother!" they cried from 100 throats, 1,000, 10,000. "Mother!" they sang, their fingers brushing her legs as she flew by. "Mother! Mother! Mother!" Davos. Sir Courtney Penrose wore no armour. He sat a sorrel stallion, his standard-bearer a dapple grey. Above them flapped Baratheon's crown stag and the cross quills of Penrose, white on a russet field. Sir Courtney's spade-shaped beard was russet as well, though he'd gone wholly bald on top. If the size and splendour of the king's party impressed him, it did not show on that weathered face. They trotted up with much clinking of chain and rattle of plate. Even Davis wore mail, though he could not have said why. His shoulders and lower back ached from the unaccustomed weight. It made him feel cumbered and foolish, and he wondered once more why he was here.
"It is not for me to question the king's commands, and yet..."
Every man of the party was of better birth and higher station than Davis Seaworth, and the great lords glittered in the morning sun. Silvered steel and gold inlays brightened their armour, and their war helms were crested in a riot of silken plumes, feathers, and cunningly wrought heraldic beasts with gemstone eyes. Stannis himself looked out of place in this rich and royal company. Like Davos, the king was plainly garbed in wool and boiled leather, though the circlet of red gold about his temples lent him a certain grandeur. Sunlight flashed off its flame-shaped points whenever he moved his head. This was the closest Davos had come to his grace in the 8 days since Black Betha had joined the rest of the fleet off Storm's End. He'd sought an audience within an hour of his arrival, only to be told that the king was occupied. The king was often occupied, Davos learned from his son, Devon, one of the royal squires. Now that Stannis Baratheon had come into power, his lordlings buzzed around him like flies around a corpse. "He looks half a corpse, too, years older than when I left Dragonstone." Devon said the king scarcely slept of late. "Since Lord Renly died, he has been troubled by terrible nightmares," the boy had confided to his father. "Maester's potions do not touch them. Only the Lady Melisande can soothe him to sleep."
"Oh, is that why she shares his pavilion now?" Davos wondered. "To pray with him? Or does she have another way to soothe him to sleep?"
It was an unworthy question, and one he dared not ask, even of his own son. Devon was a good boy, but he wore the flaming heart proudly on his doublet, and his father had seen him at the night fires at Duskfell, beseeching the Lord of Light to bring the dawn.
"He is a king's squire," he told himself. "It is only to be expected that he would take the king's guard."
Davos had almost forgotten how high and thick the walls of Storm's End loomed up close. King Stannis halted beneath them, a few feet from Sir Courtney and his standard-bearer.
"Sir," he said with stiff courtesy. He made no move to dismount.
"My lord."
That was less courteous, but not unexpected.
"It is customary to grant a king the style Your Grace," announced Lord Florent.
A red gold fox poked its shiny snout out from his breastplate through a circlet of lapis lazuli flowers. Very tall, very courtly, and very rich. The Lord of Brightwater Keep had been the first of Renly's bannermen to declare for Stannis, and the first to renounce his old gods and take up the Lord of Light. Stannis had left his queen on Dragonstone, along with her uncle, Axel. But the queen's men were more numerous and powerful than ever, and Alistair Florent was the foremost. Sir Courtney Penrose ignored him, preferring to address Stannis.
"This is a notable company. The great lords Estamont, Errol, and Varna, Sir John of the Green Apple Fossaways, and Sir Brian of the Red, Lord Carron and Sir Gaillard of King Renly's Rainbow Guard, and the puissant Lord Alistair Florent, of Brightwater, to be sure. Is that your onion knight I spy to the rear? Well met, Sir Davos. I fear I do not know the lady."
"I am named Melisande, sir."
She alone came unarmored, but for her flowing red robes. At her throat, the great ruby drank the daylight.
"I serve your king and the Lord of Light."
"I wish you well of them, my lady," Sir Courtney answered, "but I bow to other gods and a different king."
"There is but one true king and one true god," announced Lord Florent.
"Are we here to dispute theology, my lord? Had I known, I would have brought a scepter.
You know full well why we're here, said Stannis. You have had a fortnight to consider my offer. You sent your ravens. No help has come, nor will it. Storm's End stands alone, and I am out of patience. One last time, sir. I command you to open your gates and deliver me that which is mine by rights.
And the terms, said Sir Courtenay,
remain as before, said Stannis. I will pardon you for your treason, as I have pardoned these lords you see behind me. The men of your garrison will be free to enter my service or to return unmolested to their homes. You may keep your weapons and as much property as a man can carry. I will require your horses and pack animals, however.
And what of Edric Storm? My brother's bastard must be surrendered to me. Then my answer is still no, my lord.
The king clenched his jaw. He said nothing. Melisandre spoke instead.
May the Lord of Light protect you in your darkness, Sir Courtenay.
May the others bugger your Lord of Light, Penrose spat back, and wipe his arse with that rag you bear.
Lord Alistair Florent cleared his throat.
Sir Courtenay, mind your tongue. His grace means the boy no harm. The child is his own blood, and mine as well. My niece Delena was the mother, as all men know. If you will not trust to the king, trust to me. You know me for a man of honour.
I know you for a man of ambition, Sir Courtenay broke in. A man who changes kings and gods the way I change my boots, as do these other turn cloaks I see before me.
An angry clamour went up from the king's men.
Oh, he's not far wrong, Davos thought.
Only a short time before, the Fossaways, Gaillard Morrigan, and the lords Carron, Varna, Errol, and Estamont had all belonged to Renly. They had sat in his pavilion, helped him make his battle plans, plotted how Stannis might be brought low, and Lord Florent had been with them. He might be Queen Selyse's own uncle, but that had not kept the Lord of Brightwater from bending his knee to Renly when Renly's star was rising. Bryce Carron walked his horse forward a few paces, his long rainbow-striped cloak twisting in the wind off the bay.
No man here is a turncloak, sir. My fealty belongs to Storm's End, and King Stannis is its rightful lord, and a true king. He is the last of House Baratheon, Robert's heir, and Renly's.
If that is so, why is the Knight of Flowers not among you? And where is Mathis Rowan, Randall Tarley, Lady Oakheart? Why are they not here in your company? They who loved Renly best. Where is Brienne of Tarth, I ask you?
That one, Sir Gaillard Morrigan laughed harshly. She ran, as well she might. Hers was the hand that slew the king.
A lie, Sir Courtenay said. I knew Brienne when she was no more than a girl playing at her father's knee in Evenfall Hall, and I knew her still better when the Evenstar sent her here to Storm's End. She loved Renly Baratheon. From the first moment she laid eyes on him, a blind man could see it.
To be sure, declared Lord Florent airily, and she would scarcely be the first maid maddened to murder by a man who spurned her, though for my own part I believe it was Lady Stark who slew the king. She had journeyed all the way from Riverrun to plead for an alliance, and Renly had refused her. No doubt she saw him as a danger to her son, and so removed him.
It was Brienne, insisted Lord Carron. Sir Eamon Kai swore as much before he died. You have my oath on that, Sir Courtenay. Contempt thickened Sir Courtenay's voice.
And what is that worth? You wear your cloak of many colours, I see. The one Renly gave you when you swore your oath to protect him. If he is dead, how is it you are not?
He turned his scorn on Gaillard Morrigan.
I might ask the same of you, sir. Gaillard the Green, yes? Of the Rainbow Guard, sworn to give his own life for his king's? If I had such a cloak, I would be ashamed to wear it.
Morrigan bristled. Be glad this is a parley, Penrose, or I would have your tongue for those words.
And cast it in the same fire where you left your manhood.
Enough! Stannis said. The Lord of Light willed that my brother die for his treason. Who did the deed matters not.
Not to you, perhaps, said Sir Courtenay. I have heard your proposal, Lord Stannis. Now here is mine.
He pulled off his glove and flung it full in the king's face.
Single combat, sword, lance, or any weapon you care to name. Or if you fear to hazard your magic sword and royal skin against an old man, name you a champion, and I shall do the same.
He gave Gaillard Morrigan and Bryce Caron a scathing look.
Either of these pups would do nicely, I should think.
Sir Gaillard Morrigan grew dark with fury.
I will take up the gage if it please the king.
As would I.
Bryce Caron looked to Stannis. The king ground his teeth.
No.
Sir Courtenay did not seem surprised.
Is it the justice of your cause you doubt, my lord, or the strength of your arm? Are you afraid I'll piss on your burning sword and put it out?
You take me for an utter fool, sir? Asked Stannis. I've 20,000 men. You are besieged by land and sea. Why would I choose single combat when my eventual victory is certain?
The king pointed a finger at him.
I give you fair warning. If you force me to take my castle by storm, you may expect no mercy. I will hang you for traitors, every one of you.
As the gods will it, bring on your storm, my lord, and recall, if you do, the name of this castle.
Sir Courtenay gave a pull on his reins and rode back toward the gate. Stannis said no word, but turned his horse around and started back towards his camp. The others followed.
If we storm these walls, thousands will die, fretted ancient Lord Estamont, who was the king's grandfather on his mother's side. Better to hazard but a single life, surely. Our cause is righteous, so the gods must surely bless our champion's arms with victory.
God, old man, thought Davos, you forget we have only one now, Melisandre, Lord of Light.
Sir John Fosseway said,
I would gladly take this challenge myself, though I'm not half the swordsman Lord Caron is, or Sir Gaillard. Renly left no notable knights at Storm's End. Garrison duty is for old men and green boys.
Lord Caron agreed.
An easy victory, to be sure. And what glory to win Storm's End with a single stroke.
Stannis raked them all with a look.
You chatter like magpies, and with less sense. I will have quiet.
The king's eyes fell on Davos.
Sir, ride with me.
He spurred his horse away from his followers. Only Melisandre kept pace, bearing the great standard of the fiery heart with the crowned stag within.
As if it had been swallowed whole.
Davos saw the looks that passed between the lordlings as he rode past them to join the king. These were no onion knights, but proud men from houses whose names were old in honour. Somehow he knew that Renly had never chided them in such a fashion. The youngest of the Baratheons had been born with a gift for easy courtesy that his brother sadly lacked. He eased back to a slow trot when his horse came up beside the king's.
Your Grace!
Seen at close hand, Stannis looked worse than Davos had realized from afar. His face had grown haggard, and he had dark circles under his eyes.
A smuggler must be a fair judge of men, the king said. What do you make of Sir Courtenay Penrose?
A stubborn man, said Davos carefully.
Hungry for death, I call it. He throws my pardon in my face. Aye, and throws his life away in the bargain, and the lives of every man inside those walls. Single combat, tchah! The king snorted in derision. No doubt he mistook me for Robert. More like he was desperate. What other hope does he have? None. The castle will fall. But how to do it quickly?
Stannis brooded on that for a moment. Under the steady clop-clop of hooves, Davos could hear the faint sound of the king grinding his teeth.
Lord Alistair urges me to bring old Lord Penrose here. Sir Courtenay's father. You know the man, I believe. When I came as your envoy, Lord Penrose received me more courteously than most, Davos said.
He's an old dun man, sire, sickly and failing.
Florent would have him fail more visibly. In his son's sight were the noose about his neck. It was dangerous to oppose the queen's men, but Davos had vowed always to tell his king the truth.
I think that would be ill done, my liege. Sir Courtney will watch his father die before he would ever betray his trust. It would gain us nothing, and bring dishonour to our cause.
What dishonour? Stannis bristled. Would you have me spare the lives of traitors?
You have spared the lives of those behind us.
Do you scold me for that, smuggler?
It is not my place.
Davos feared he had said too much. The king was relentless. You esteem this Penrose more than you do my lord's bannermen.
Why? He keeps faith.
A misplaced faith in a dead usurper.
Yes, Davos admitted, but still he keeps faith.
As those behind us do not. Davos had come too far with Stannis to play coy now.
Last year they were Robert's men. A moon ago they were Renly's. This morning they are yours. Whose will they be on the morrow?
And Stannis laughed, a sudden gust, rough and full of scorn. I told you, Melisande, he said to the Red Woman, my Onion Knight tells me the truth.
I see you know him well, Your Grace, the Red Woman said.
Davos, I've missed you sorely, the king said. Aye, I have a tale of traitors. Your nose does not deceive you. My lord's bannermen are inconstant, even in their treasons.
I need them. But you should know how it sickens me to pardon such as these when I have punished better men for lesser crimes. You have every right to reproach me, Sir Davos.
You reproach yourself more than I ever could, Your Grace. You must have these great lords to win your throne.
Fingers and all, it seems, Stannis smiled grimly. Unthinking, Davos raised his maimed hand to the pouch at his throat and felt the finger bones within.
Look.
The king saw the motion. Are they still there, Onion Knight? You have not lost them.
No.
Why do you keep them? I've often wondered.
They remind me of what I was, where I came from. They remind me of your justice, my liege.
It was justice, Stannis said. A good act does not wash out the bad, nor a bad act the good. Each should have its own reward. You were a hero and a smuggler. He glanced behind at Lord Florent and the others, rainbow knights and turncloaks who were following at a distance. These pardon lords would do well to reflect on that. Good men and true will fight for Joffrey, wrongly believing him the true king. A Northman might even say the same of Robb Stark. But these lords, who flocked to my brother's banners, knew him for a usurper. They turned their backs on their rightful king for no better reason than dreams of power and glory, and I have marked them for what they are. Pardon them, yes, forgiven, but not forgotten. He fell silent for a moment, brooding on his plans for justice. And then abruptly he said, what do the small folk say of Renly's death?
They grieve. Your brother was well loved.
Fools love a fool, grumbled Stannis. But I grieve for him as well. For the boy he was, not the man he grew to be. He was silent for a time, and then he said, how did the commons take the news of Cersei's incest?
While we were among them, they shouted for King Stannis. I cannot speak for what they said once we had sailed.
So you do not think they believed?
When I was smuggling, I learned that some men believe everything and some nothing. We met both sorts. And there is another tale being spread as well.
Yes, Stannis bit off the word. Selyse has given me horns and tied a fool's bell to the end of each. My daughter, fathered by a half-wit jester. A tale as vile as it is absurd. Renly threw it in my teeth when we met to parley. You would need to be as mad as Patchface to believe such a thing.
Or that may be so, my liege. But whether they believe the story or no, they delight to tell it.
In many places
It had come before them, poisoning the well for their own true tale. Robert could piss in a cup and men would call it wine, but I offer them pure cold water, and they squint in suspicion and mutter to each other about how queer it tastes. Stannis ground his teeth. If someone said I had magicked myself into a boar to kill Robert, likely they would believe that as well.
You cannot stop them talking, my liege, Davos said. But when you take your vengeance on your brother's true killers, the realm will know such tales for lies.
Stannis only seemed to half hear him. I have no doubts that Cersei had a hand in Robert's death. I will have justice for him, aye, and for Ned Stark, and John Aaron as well.
And for Renly?
The words were out before Davos could stop to consider them. For a long time, the king did not speak. Then very softly he said,
I dream of it sometimes, of Renly's dying. A green tent, candles, a woman screaming, and blood.
Stannis looked down at his hands.
I was still abed when he died. Your Devon will tell you. He tried to wake me. Dawn was nigh, and my lords were waiting, fretting. I should have been a horse, armoured. I knew Renly would attack at break of day. Devon says I thrashed and cried out, but what does it matter? It was a dream. I was in my tent when Renly died, and when I woke, my hands were clean.
Sir Davos Seaworth could feel his phantom fingertips start to itch.
Something is wrong here,
the one-time smuggler thought, yet he nodded and said,
I see.
Renly offered me a peach at our parley, mocked me, defied me, threatened me, and offered me a peach. I thought he was drawing a blade, and went for mine own. What was his purpose? To make me show fear? Or was it one of his pointless jests? When he spoke of how sweet the peach was, did his words have some hidden meaning?
The king gave a shake of his head, like a dog shaking a rabbit to snap its neck.
Only Renly could vex me so with a piece of fruit. He brought his doom on himself with his treason. But I did love him, Davos. I know that now. I swear I will go to my grave, thinking of my brother's peach.
By then, they were in amongst the camp, riding past the ordered rows of tents, the blowing banners, and the stacks of shields and spears. The stink of horse dung was heavy in the air, mingled with the wood smoke and the smell of cooking meat. Stannis reined up long enough to bark a brusque dismissal to Lord Florent and the others, commanding them to attend him in his pavilion 1 hour hence for a council of war. They bowed their heads and dispersed, while Davos and Melisandre rode to the king's pavilion. The tent had to be large, since it was there his lord's bannerman came to council. Yet there was nothing grand about it. It was a soldier's tent of heavy canvas, dyed the dark yellow that sometimes passed for gold. Only the royal banner that streamed atop the centre pole marked it as a king's. That and the guards without. Queen's men leaning on tall spears, with the badge of the Fiery Heart sewn over their own. Grooms came up to help them dismount. One of the guards relieved Melisandre of her cumbersome standard, driving the staff deep into the soft ground. Devon stood to one side of the door, waiting to lift the flap for the king. An older squire waited beside him. Stannis took off his crown and handed it to Devon.
Cold water, cups for two. Davos, attend me. My lady, I shall send for you when I require you.
As the king commands, Melisandre bowed.
After the brightness of the morning, the interior of the pavilion seemed cool and dim. Stannis seated himself on a plain wooden camp stool and waved Davos to another.
One day I may make you a lord, smuggler, if only to irk Celtigar and Florent. You will not thank me, though. It will mean you must suffer through these councils and feign interest in the braying of mules.
Why do you have them, if they serve no purpose?
The mules love the sound of their own braying. Why else? And I need them to haul my cart.
Oh, to be sure, once in a great while, some useful notion is put forward. But not today, I think. Ah, here's your son, with our water.
Devon set the tray on the table and filled two clay cups. The king sprinkled a pinch of salt in his cup before he drank. Davos took his water straight, wishing it were wine.
You were speaking of your council. Let me tell you how it will go. Lord Valerian will urge me to storm the castle walls at first light, grapnels and scaling ladders against arrows and boiling oil. The young mules will think this a splendid notion. Estamont will favour settling down to starve them out, as Tyrell and red wine once tried with me. That might take a year, but old mules are patient, and Lord Caron and the others, who like to kick, will want to take up Sir Courtney's gauntlet and hazard all upon a single combat. Each one imagining he will be my champion and win undying fame.
The king finished his water. What would you have me do, smuggler? Davos considered for a moment before he answered.
Strike for King's Landing at once.
The king snorted.
And leave Storm's End untaken? Sir Courtney does not have the power to harm you. The Lannisters do. A siege would take too long. Single combat is too chancy, and an assault would cost thousands of lives with no certainty of success. And there is no need. Once you dethrone Joffrey, this castle must come to you with all the rest. It is said about the camp that Lord Tywin Lannister rushes west to rescue Lannisport from the vengeance of the Northmen.
You have a passing clever father, Devon, the king told the boy, standing by his elbow. He makes me wish I had more smugglers in my service, and fewer lords. Though you are wrong in one respect, Davos, there is a need. If I leave Storm's End untaken in my rear, it will be said I was defeated here, and that I cannot permit. Men do not love me as they love my brothers. They follow me because they fear me, and defeat is death to fear. The castle must fall.
His jaw ground side to side. Aye, and quickly. Doran Martell has called his banners and fortified the mountain passes. His Dornishmen are poised to sweep down onto the marches, and Highgarden is far from spent. My brother left the greater part of his power at Bitterbridge, near 60,000 foot. I sent my wife's brother, Sir Errol, with Sir Parman Crane to take them under my command, but they have not returned. I fear that Sir Loras Tyrell reached Bitterbridge before my envoys, and took that host for his own. All the more reason to take King's Landing as soon as we may. Salador San told me. Salador San thinks only of gold. Stannis exploded. His head is full of dreams, of the treasure he fancies lies under the Red Keep. So let us hear no more of Salador San. The day I need military counsel from a Lycian brigand is the day I put off my crown and take the black.
The king made a fist.
Are you here to serve me, smuggler, or to vex me with arguments?
I am yours, Davos said. Then hear me. Sir Courtney's lieutenant is cousin to the Fossaways. Lord Meadows, a green boy of 20. Should some ill chance strike down Penrose, command of Storm's End would pass to this stripling, and his cousins believe he would accept my terms and yield up the castle. I remember another stripling who was given command of Storm's End. He could not have been much more than 20.
Lord Meadows is not as stonehead stubborn as I was.
Stubborn or craven, what does it matter? Sir Courtney Penrose seemed hale and hearty to me.
So did my brother. The day before his death. The night is dark and full of terrors, Davos.
Davos Seaworth felt the small hairs rising on the back of his neck.
My lord, I do not understand you.
I do not require your understanding, only your service. Sir Courtney will be dead within the day. Melisande has seen it in the flames of the future. His death, and the manner of it. He will not die in knightly combat, needless to say.
Stannis held out his cup, and Devon filled it again from the flagon. Her flames do not lie. She saw Renly's doom as well. On Dragonstone she saw it, and told Selyse. Lord Valerian and your friend Salador San would have had me sail against Joffrey, but Melisandre told me that if I went to Storm's End, I would win the best part of my brother's power. And she was right. Davos stammered, Lord Renly only came here because you had laid siege to the castle. He was marching towards King's Landing before her, against the Lannisters. He would have...
Stannis shifted in his seat, frowning.
Was, would have, what is that? He did what he did. He came here with his banners and his speeches to his doom. And it was well for me he did. Melisandre saw another day in her flames as well. A morrow where Renly rode out of the south in his green armour to smash my host beneath the walls of King's Landing. Had I met my brother there, it might have been me who died in place of him. Or you might have joined your strength to his to bring down the Lannisters, Davos protested. Why not that? If she saw two futures, well, both cannot be true.
King Stannis pointed a finger.
There you are on your night. Some lights cast more than one shadow. Stand before the night fire, and you see for yourself. The flames shift and dance, never still. The shadows grow tall and short, and every man casts a dozen. Some are fainter than others, that's all. Well, men cast their shadows across the future as well. One shadow or many, Melisandre sees them all. You do not love the woman. I know that, Davos. I'm not blind. My lords mislike her, too. Estamont thinks the Flaming Heart ill-chosen, and begs to fight beneath the crown staggers of old. Sir Gaiad says a woman should not be my standard-bearer. Others whisper that she has no place in my war councils, that I ought to send her back to Shai, that it is sinful to keep her in my tent of a night. Aye, they whisper, while she serves. Serves? How? Davos asked, dreading the answer. As needed. The king looked at him. And you? I? Davos licked his lips. I am yours to command. What would you have me do? Nothing you have not done before. Only land a boat beneath the castle unseen in the black of night. Can you do that? Yes. Tonight. The king gave a curt nod. You will need a small boat, not Black Betha. No one must know what you do.
Davos wanted to protest. He was a knight now, no longer a smuggler, and he had never been an assassin. Yet when he opened his mouth, the words would not come. This was Stannis, his just lord, to whom he owed all he was, and he had his sons to consider as well.
God be good. What has she done to him?
You are quiet, Stannis observed.
And should remain so, Davos told himself. But instead he said, My liege, you must have the castle, I see that now, but surely there are other ways, cleaner ways. Let Sir Courtney keep the bastard boy, and he may well yield.
I must have the boy, Davos, must. Melisandre has seen that in the flames as well. Davos groped for some other answer.
Storm's End owes no knight who can match Sir Gaillard or Lord Caron, or any of 100 others sworn to your service. This single combat, could it be that Sir Courtney seeks for a way to yield with honour, even if it means his own life?
A troubled look crossed the king's face, like a passing cloud. More like he planned some treachery. There will be no combat of champions. Sir Courtney was dead before he ever threw that glove. The flames do not lie, Davos.
Yet they require me to make them true, he thought.
It had been a long time since Davos Seaworth felt so sad. And so it was that he found himself once more crossing Shipbreaker Bay in the dark of night, steering a tiny boat with a black sail. The sky was the same, and the sea. The same salt smell was in the air, and the water chuckling against the hull was just as he remembered it. 1,000 flickering campfires burned around the castle, as the fires of the Tyrells and Redwines had 16 years before. But all the rest was different.
"The last time it was life I brought to Storm's End, shaped to look like onions. This time it is death, in the shape of Melisande, of Ashai."
16 years ago, the sails had cracked and snapped with every shift of wind, until he'd pulled them down and gone on with muffled oars. Even so, his heart had been in his gullet. The men on the red wine galleys had grown lax after so long, however, and they had slipped through the cordon smooth as black satin. This time, the only ships in sight belonged to Stannis, and the only danger would come from watchers on the castle walls. Even so, Davos was taut as a bowstring. Melisande huddled upon a thwart, lost in the folds of a dark red cloak that covered her from head to heels, her face a paleness beneath the cowl. Davos loved the water. He slept best when he had a deck rocking beneath him, and the sighing of the wind in his rigging was a sweeter sound to him than any singer could make with his harp strings. Even the sea brought him no comfort tonight, though.
"I can smell the fear on you, Sir Knight,"
the Red Woman said softly.
"Someone once told me the night is dark and full of terrors, and tonight I am no knight. Tonight I am Davos, the smuggler again. Would that you were an onion."
She laughed.
"Is it me you fear, or what we do?" "What you do, I'll have no part of it." "Your hand raised the sail. Your hand holds the tiller."
Silent, Davos tended to his course. The shore was a snarl of rocks, so he was taking them well out across the bay. He would wait for the tide to turn before coming about. Storm's End dwindled behind them, but the Red Woman seemed unconcerned.
"Are you a good man, Davos Seaworth?" she asked. "Would a good man be doing this?" "I am a man," he said. "I am kind to my wife, but I have known other women. I've tried to be a father to my sons, to help make them a place in this world. I've broken laws, but I've never felt evil until tonight. I would say my parts are mixed, my lady, good and bad."
"A grey man," she said, "neither white nor black, but partaking of both. Is that what you are?" said Davos.
"What if I am? It seems to me that most men are grey."
"If half of an onion is black with rot, it is a rotten onion. A man is good, or he is evil."
The fires behind them had melted into one vague glow against the black sky, and the land was almost out of sight. It was time to come about.
"Watch your head, milady."
He pushed on the tiller, and the small boat threw up a curl of black water as she turned. Melisande leaned under the swinging yard, one hand on the gunwale, calm as ever. Wood creaked, canvas cracked, and water splashed, so loudly a man might swear the castle was sure to hear. Davos knew better. The endless crash of wave on rock was the only sound that ever penetrated the massive seaward walls of Storm's End, and that but faintly. A rippling wake spread out behind as they swung back toward the shore.
"You speak of men and onions," Davos said to Melisande. "What of women? Is it not the same for them? Are you good or evil, my lady?"
That made her chuckle.
"Oh, good. I am a knight of sorts myself, sweet sir, a champion of light and life."
"Yet you mean to kill a man tonight," he said, "as you killed Maester Cressin."
"Your maester poisoned himself. He meant to poison me, but I was protected by a greater power, and he was not."
"And Renly Baratheon, who was it killed him?"
Her head turned beneath the shadow of the cowl. Her eyes burned like pale red candle flames.
"Not I."
"Liar,"
Davis was certain now. Melisande laughed again.
"You are lost in darkness and confusion, Sir Davis.